This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents Mary Mary, written by James Patterson and read by Peter J. Fernandez, Michael Lewis Wells, and Melissa Leo. The Storyteller. Chapter 1.
Act 1, Scene 1, the storyteller thought to himself, and couldn't hold back a dizzying rush of anticipation. The truth was that ordinary people committed perfect crimes and perfect murders all the time, but you didn't hear about it for the simple reason that the killers never got caught. And neither would he, of course. That was a given in the story he was about to tell. Which didn't mean that today wasn't nerve-wracking. Actually, this was the most intense moment in the past couple of insane years for him. He was ready to kill somebody, a complete stranger, and he'd figured out that New York City was the right place for his first. It almost happened just outside a basement restroom in Bloomingdale's, but he didn't feel right about the location. Too crowded, even at 10:30 in the morning. Too noisy, and yet not noisy enough to provide the proper distraction. Plus, he didn't like the idea of trying to escape out onto the unfamiliar territory of Lexington Avenue, or especially down into the claustrophobic IRT subway tunnels. When it felt right, he'd know it and act accordingly. So the storyteller moved on and decided to catch a flick at the Sutton Theater on East 57th Street, a funky rundown place that had obviously seen better days. Maybe this was a good place for a murder. He liked the irony, even if he was the only one who got it. Yes, maybe this was going to work out great, he thought, as he sat in one of the two small auditoriums inside. He began to watch Kill Bill Volume 2, with 7 other Tarantino aficionados. Which one of these unsuspecting people would be his victim? You? You? You there? The storyteller spun the tale inside his head. There were 2 loudmouths in identical New York Yankees baseball caps, worn backward, of course. The irritating morons didn't shut up once through the interminable ads and trailers. They both deserved to die. So did an atrociously dressed elderly couple, who didn't talk to each other at all, not once in 15 minutes before the house lights went down. Killing them would be a good deed, almost a public service. A fragile-looking woman, early 40s, seemed to be having the shakes 2 rows in front of the moldy oldies, bothering no one, except him. And then a big black dude with his sneakered feet up on the seat in front of him, rude, inconsiderate bastard in his old-school Converse that must have been at least size 14s. Next, a black-bearded movie nerd, who probably had seen the movie 12 times already and worshipped Quentin Tarantino, of course. Turned out it was the bearded wonder who got up halfway through the movie, just after Uma Thurman was buried alive. Jesus, who could walk out on that classic scene? Duty-bound he followed, a couple of seconds behind. Out into the dingy hall, then into the men's room, which was located near Theater 2. He was actually shaking now. Was this it? His moment? His first murder? The beginning of everything he'd dreamed about for months? Make that years? He was pretty much on autopilot, trying not to think about anything except getting this done right, then getting in and out of the movie theater without anybody noticing his face or too much else about him. The bearded guy was standing at the urinal, which was kind of good news, actually. The shot was nicely framed and art-directed. Wrinkled, grungy black t-shirt that said NYU Film School, with a Clapsticks logo on the back. Reminded him of a character out of a Daniel Clowes comic book, and that graphic shit was hot right now. And action, he said. Then he shot the poor bearded loser in the back of the head. Watched him drop like a heavy sack to the bathroom floor. Lie there, nothing moving. The blast roared through his head in the tiled room. louder than he dreamed it would be.
Hey, what the...
What happened?
Hey!
He heard, and the storyteller whirled around as if there was an audience watching him in the men's room. Two guys from the Sutton Theater crew had entered behind him. They must have been curious about the noise. And how much had they seen?
A heart attack,
he said, blurted it out, tried to sound convincing. Man just fell over at the urinal. Help me get him up, poor guy, he's bleeding. No panic, no affect, no second thoughts whatsoever. Everything was pure instinct now, right, wrong, or indifferent. He raised his gun and shot both theater workers as they stood wall-eyed and dorky at the door. He shot them again when they were down on the floor. Just to be careful. Professional. And now he was really shaking. Legs like J-E-double-L-O, but trying to walk very calmly out of the men's room. Then out of the Sutton Theater onto 57th, heading east on foot. Everything outside feeling completely unreal and otherworldly. Everything so bright and brassy. He'd done it. He'd killed three people instead of just one. His first three murders. It was just practice. But he'd done it. And you know what? He could do it again. Practice makes perfect. The storyteller whispered under his breath as he hurried toward his car. His getaway car, right? God, this was the best feeling of his life. Of course, that didn't say much for his life up to now, did it? But watch out from here on. Just watch out. For Mary Mary, quite contrary. Of course, he was the only one who got that. So far, anyway.
Chapter 2.
You think you can kill again in cold blood? He asked himself many times after the New York murders. You think you can stop this now that you've started? You think? The storyteller waited. Almost 5 months of self-torture, also known as discipline, or professionalism, or maybe cowardice, until it was his time. Then he arrived in the kill zone again, and this time it wasn't going to be practice. This was the real deal, and it wasn't a stranger who was going to die. He was just a face in the crowd at the 3:10 showing of The Village at the Westwood Village Theater in Los Angeles. There were a number of patrons, which was good news for him, and he supposed for the film's star director, M. Night Shyamalan. What kind of name was that? M. Night. Self-conscious phony. Apparently, Patrice Bennett was among the last people in town to see the horror film. Also, Patrice actually deigned to sit in a real movie theater with real ticket buyers for her movie fix. How quaint was that? Well, she was famous for it, wasn't she? It was Patrice's shtick. She'd even bought her ticket ahead of time, which was how he knew she'd be there. So this wasn't target practice anymore, and everything had to be just right. And it would be. Never a doubt. The story was already written in his head. For one thing, he couldn't be spotted by anyone in the theater. So he went to the 12 o'clock. Then when the show let out, he waited around in a bathroom stall until the 3:10. Nail-biting, nerve-thwacking ordeal, but not that bad, really. Especially since if he was spotted, he'd simply abort the mission. But the storyteller wasn't seen, at least he didn't think so, and he didn't see anyone he knew. Now the theater had more than 100 viewers, or rather, suspects, right? At least a dozen of them were perfect for his purposes. Most important, his gun had a silencer now, something he'd learned from the thrill-packed run-through in New York City. Patrice sat in the balcony. Works for me, Patsy, he thought. You're being way too thoughtful, especially for you, you uber bitch. He was watching her from across the aisle and a few rows behind. This was so delicious. He wanted the luxurious anticipation of revenge to go on. Except that he also wanted to pull the trigger and get the hell out of the Westwood Theater before something went wrong. But what could go wrong, right? When Joaquin Phoenix got stabbed by Adrian Brody, he calmly rose from his seat and went directly to Patrice's aisle. He never hesitated for an instant. "Excuse me, sorry," he said, and started to make his way past her, actually over her bare, skinny legs, which weren't very impressive for such an important woman in Hollywood.
"Jesus Christ, will you watch it?"
she complained, which was just like her, so unnecessarily nasty and imperial-sounding.
"Not exactly who you can expect to see next. Not Jesus," he quipped, and wondered if Patrice got his little joke.
Probably not. Studio heads didn't get subtlety. He shot her twice, once in the heart, and once right between her totally shocked, blown-away eyes. There was no such thing as too dead when it came to this kind of power-mad psycho. Patrice could probably come back at you from the grave, like that reverse trapdoor ending in the original Carrie, Stephen King's first story to reach the silver screen. Then he made his perfect escape. Just like in the movies, eh? The story had begun.
Part 1. The Mary Smith Murders. Chapter 3.
2. A. Greiner at LATimes.com. From Mary Smith.
Arnold Greiner squeezed his small, squinty eyes shut, put his hands over his practically hairless skull, and scrubbed his scalp hard.
"Oh, God save me, not another one," he was thinking. "Life is too short for this shit. I can't take it. I really can't take this Mary Smith deal."
The LA Times newsroom buzzed around him as if it were any other morning. Phones jangling, people coming and going like indoor race walkers. Someone nearby pontificating about the new fall TV lineup. As if anybody cared about the TV lineup these days. How could Greiner feel so vulnerable sitting at his own desk, in his cubicle office, in the middle of all this? But he did. The Xanax he'd been popping since the first Mary Smith email a week ago did absolutely nothing to hold back the spike of panic that shot through him like the needle used in a spinal tap. Panic, but also morbid curiosity. Maybe he was just an entertainment columnist. But Arnold Greiner knew a huge news story when he saw one. A blockbuster that would dominate the front page for weeks. Someone rich and famous had just been murdered in Los Angeles. He didn't even have to read the email to know that much. Mary Smith had already proved herself to be one sick lady and true to her word. The questions attacking his brain were, who had been killed this time? And what the hell was he, Greiner, doing in the middle of this awful mess? Why me, of all people? There has to be a good reason, and if I knew it, then I'd really be freaking, wouldn't I? As he dialed 911 with a badly shaking hand, he clicked open Mary Smith's message with the other. Please, God, no one I know. No one I like. He began to read, even though everything inside told him not to. He really couldn't help himself. Oh, God, Antonia Schiffman. Oh, poor Antonia. Oh, no, why her? Antonia was one of the good people, and there weren't too many of those.
To Antonia Schiffman. I guess you could call this anti-fan mail, although I used to be a fan. Anyhow, 4:30 in the morning is awfully early for a brilliant 3-time Academy Award winner and mother of 4 to leave the house and her children, don't you think? I suppose it's the price we pay for being who we are, or at least it's one of them. I was there this morning to show you another downside of fame and fortune in Beverly Hills. It was pitch black dark when the driver came to take you to the set. There's a sacrifice you make that your fans don't begin to appreciate. I walked right in the front gates behind the car and followed him up the driveway. Suddenly, I had the feeling that your driver had to die if I wanted to get to you. But still, there wasn't any pleasure in killing him. I was too nervous for that, shaking like a sapling in a fierce storm. The gun was actually trembling in my hand when I knocked on his window. I kept it hidden behind my back and told him you'd be down in a few minutes. No problem, he said. And you know what? He barely even looked at me. Why should he? You are the star of stars. 15 million a picture, I've read. I was just the maid as far as he was concerned. It felt like I was playing a bit part in one of your movies, but trust me, I was planning to steal this scene. I knew I had to do something pretty dramatic soon. He was going to wonder why I was still standing there. I didn't know if I'd be too scared to do it if he actually looked at me. But then he did. And everything just happened. I shoved the gun into his face and pulled the trigger. Such a tiny action. Almost a reflex. A second later, he was dead. Just blown away. I could do pretty much whatever I wanted to now. So I walked around to the passenger side, climbed inside the car, and waited for you. Nice, nice car. So plush and comfortable, with leather, soft lighting, a bar and small refrigerator stocked with all your favorites. Twix bars, Antonia? Shame, shame. In a way, it was too bad you came out of the house so soon. I liked being in your limo, the quiet time, the luxury. In those few minutes, I could see why you would want to be who you are, or at least, who you were. My heart is beating faster just writing this, remembering the moment. You stood outside the car for a second before you opened the door for yourself, dressed down, without makeup, yet still breathtaking. You couldn't see me or the dead driver through the one-way glass, but I could see you. That's how it's been all week, Antonia. I've been right there, and you've never noticed me. What an incredible moment this was for me. Me, inside your car. You, outside, in a tweed jacket that made you look very Irish and down to earth. When you got in, I immediately locked the doors and put down the partition. You got this amazing look on your face the second you saw me. I'd seen that same look before. In your movies, when you pretended to be afraid. What you probably didn't realize was that I was just as scared as you. My whole body was quivering. My teeth were hitting together. That's why I shot you before either of us could say anything. The moment went by way too fast, but I had planned on that. That's what the knife was for. I just hope it isn't your children who find you. I wouldn't want them to see you that way. All they need to know is that Mommy is gone, and she's not coming back. Those poor children. Andy, Tia, Petra, Elizabeth. They're the ones I feel so sorry for. Poor, poor babies without their mommy. Could anything be sadder? I know something that is. But that's my secret, and no one will ever know.
Chapter 4.
Mary Smith's alarm clock went off at 5:30 a.m., but she was already awake, wide awake, thinking about, of all things, how to make a porcupine costume for her daughter Ashley's school play. What would she possibly use for porcupine needles? It had been quite a late night, but she never seemed to be able to shut off the mental ticker tape that was her to-do list. They needed more peanut butter, Kid's Crest, Zyrtec syrup, and one of those little bulbs for the bathroom nightlight. Brendan had soccer practice at 3, which started at the same time as and 15 miles away from Ashley's tap class. Figure that one out. Adam's sniffles could have gone either way in the night, and Mary could not afford another sick day. Speaking of which, she needed to put in for some second shifts at her job. And this was the quiet part of the day. It wasn't long before she was at the stove, calling out orders and fielding the usual spate of morning time needs. Brendan, help your sister tie her shoes. Please, Brendan, I'm talking to you.
Mommy, my socks feel weird.
Turn them inside out.
Can I take Cleo to school? Can I please, please, Mommy? Oh, please?
Yes, but you have to get her out of the dryer. Brendan, what did I ask you to do? Mary expertly flipped a portion of perfectly fluffed scrambled eggs onto each of their plates, just as the bread in the four-slice toaster popped up. Breakfast! While the two older ones dug in, she took Adam to his room and dressed him in his red overalls and a sailor shirt. She cooed to him as she carried him back out to his high chair. Who's the handsomest sailor in town? Who's my little man? She asked and tickled him under his chinny-chin-chin. I'm your little man, Brendan said with a smile. I am, Mommy. You're my big little man, Mary returned, chucking him lightly under the chin. She squeezed his shoulders. And getting bigger every day. That's 'cause I clean my plate, he said, chasing the last bit of egg onto a fork with the flat of his thumb. You're a good cook, Mommy, Ashley said. Thank you, sweetheart. Now come on, let's go, BBWW. While she cleared the dishes, Brendan and Ashley marched back down the hallway in a sing-song chant. Brush, brush, wash, wash, teeth and hair, hands and face, brush, brush, wash, wash. While the older two washed up, she put the dishes into the sink for later, gave Adam's face a quick once-over with a wet paper towel, took the kids' lunches, packed the night before, out of the fridge, and dropped each one into the appropriate knapsack. I'm going to put Adam into his car seat, she called out. Last one outside is a googly worm. Mary hated the rotten egg thing, but she knew the value of a little innocent competition for keeping the kids in gear. She could hear them squealing in their rooms, half laughing, half scared they'd be the last one out the door and into her old jalopy. God, who said jalopy anymore? Only Mary Mary. And who said God? G-A-W-D? As she strapped Adam in, she tried to remember what it was that had kept her up so late the night before. The days, and now the nights as well, seemed to blur all together in a jumble of cooking, cleaning, driving, list-making, nose-wiping, and more driving. L.A. definitely had its major league disadvantages. It seemed as if they spent half their lives in the car, stalled in traffic. She should really get something more fuel-efficient than the big old Suburban she had brought west. She looked at her watch. Somehow, 10 minutes had gone by. 10 precious minutes. How did that always happen? How did she seem to lose time? She ran back to the front door and ushered Brendan and Ashley outside. What's taking you two so long? We're going to be late again. Jeez'em crow, just look at the time, said Mary Smith.
Chapter 5. Here we were, smack in the middle of an age of angry and cynical myth-busting, and suddenly I was being called America's Sherlock Holmes in one of the country's more influential, or at least best-read, magazines. What a complete crock that was. And it was still bugging me that morning. An investigative journalist named James Truscott had decided to follow me around and report on the murder cases I was working on. I'd fooled him, though. I'd gone on vacation with the family. I'm going to Disneyland, I told Truscott, and laughed the last time I'd seen him in D.C. The writer had only smirked in response. For anyone else, maybe a vacation was an ordinary thing. Happened all the time, twice a year sometimes. For the Cross family, it was a major event, a new beginning. Appropriately, a whole new world was playing in the hotel lobby as we passed through. Come on, you pokes! Janny urged us as she ran ahead. Damon, newly minted teenager, was somewhat more reserved. He stuck close and held the door for Nana as we passed from air-conditioned comfort out into bright Southern California sunshine. Actually, it was a full-out attack on the senses from the moment we left the hotel. Scents of cinnamon, fried dough, and some kind of zingy Mexican food reached our noses all at the same time. I could also hear the distant roar of a freight train, or so it seemed, along with screams of terror, the good kind, the don't-stop kind. I'd heard enough of the other kind to appreciate the difference. Against all odds, I had put in for vacation, been approved, and actually gotten out of town before FBI Director Burns or his people came up with a half a dozen reasons why I couldn't go away at this time. The kids' first choice had been Disney World and Epcot Village in Florida. For my own reasons, and also since it was hurricane season down south, I steered us to Disneyland and their newest park, Disney's California Adventure. California, indeed! Nana Mama shaded her eyes from the sun glare. I haven't seen a naturally occurring thing since we arrived here, Alex. Have you? She pursed her lips and pulled down the corners of her mouth, but then she couldn't help laughing, putting herself in stitches. That's Nana. She almost never laughs at other people. She laughs with them. You can't fool me, old woman. You just love to see us all together, anywhere, anyhow, anytime. We could be in Siberia for all you'd care. She brightened. Now, Siberia, that's somewhere I would like to see. A trip on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, the Sion Mountains, Lake Baikal. You know, it wouldn't kill American children to take a vacation once in a while where they actually learn something about another culture. I rolled my eyes in Damon and Janny's direction. Once a teacher, always a teacher, Janny said.
Always a teacher,
repeated little Alex. He was 3 years old, and our own little minor bird. We got to see him too infrequently, and I was partially amazed by everything he did. His mother had taken him back to Seattle more than a year ago. The painful custody struggles between Christine and me were still dragging on. Nana's voice cut through my thoughts.
Where do we go for...
Soaring over California! Janny had it out before Nana was even finished asking the question. Damon chimed in.
Okay, but then we're hitting California screaming.
Janny stuck her tongue out convivially at her brother, and he gently hip-checked her in return. It was like Christmas morning for these two. Even the disagreements were mostly in fun. Sounds like a plan, I said. And then we'll hit It's Tough to Be a Bug for your little brother. I scooped up Alex Jr. in my arms and held him close, kissed both of his cheeks. He looked back at me with his peaceable little smile. Life was good again. Chapter 6. That was when I saw James Truscott approaching, all 6'5" of him, with waves of red hair hanging down over the shoulders of a black leather jacket. Somehow, some way, Truscott had gotten his editors in New York to agree to do a continuing series on me, based on my track record for getting involved with high-profile murder cases on a fairly regular basis. Maybe it was because the last one, involving the Russian mafia, had been the worst case of my career, and also very high profile. I had taken the liberty of doing some research on Truscott. He was only 30, educated at Boston University. His specialty was true crime, and he'd published 2 nonfiction books on the mafia. A phrase I'd heard about him stuck in my head. He plays dirty.
Alex, he said, smiling and extending his hand as if we were old friends meeting by chance.
Reluctantly, I shook hands with Truscott. It wasn't that I disliked him or objected to his right to write whatever stories he wanted to, but he had already intruded into my life in ways that I felt were inappropriate, like writing daily emails and arriving at crime scenes, and even at our house in D.C. Now here he was showing up on our family vacation. Mr. Truscott, I said in a quiet voice, you know I've declined to cooperate with these articles.
No problem. He grinned. I'm cool with that.
I'm not, I said. I'm officially off the clock. This is family time. Can you give us some space? We're at Disneyland. Truscott nodded as though he understood completely. But then he said,
your vacation will be interesting to our readers. The calm before the storm kind of thing. This is great. Disneyland is perfect. You have to understand that, right?
I don't, Nana said and stepped toward Truscott.
Your right to stick out your arm ends at the other person's nose. You ever hear that wise bit of advice, young man? Well, you should have. You know, you have some kind of nerve being here.
Just then, though, I caught something even more disturbing out of the corner of my eye. A movement that didn't fit the circumstances. A woman in black, slowly circling to our left. She had a digital camera and was already taking pictures of us. Of my family. Of Nana confronting Truscott. I shielded the kids as best I could, and then I really lit into James Truscott. Don't you dare photograph my kids, I said. Now you and your girlfriend get out of here. Please, go. Truscott raised his hands over his head, smiled cockily, and then backed away. I have rights just like you, Dr. Cross. And she's not my fucking girlfriend. She's a colleague. This is all business. It's a story. Right, I said. Well, just get out of here. This little boy is 3 years old. I don't want my family story in a magazine. Not now. Not ever. Chapter 7. We all tried to forget about James Truscott and his photographer for a while after that. Did pretty good, too. After umpteen different rides, a live show starring Mickey Mouse, two snacks, and countless carnival games, I dared to suggest we head back to the hotel. For the pool? Damon asked, grinning. We had glimpsed the 5,000-square-foot Neverland pool on our way to breakfast early that morning. When I got to the front desk, there was a message waiting, one that I was expecting. Inspector Jamila Hughes of the San Francisco Police Department was in town and needed a meeting with me. ASAP, if not sooner, said the note. That means move it, Buster. I gave my smiling regrets to the pool sharks and took my leave of them. After all, I was on vacation too.
Go get him, Daddy,
Janny ribbed me.
It's Jamila, right?
Damon gave a thumbs up and a smile from behind the fogged lens of a snorkel mask. I crossed the grounds from the Disneyland Hotel to the Grand Californian, where I had booked another room. This place was an entirely American arts and crafts affair, much more sedate than our own hotel. I passed through stained glass doors into a soaring lobby. Redwood beams rose 6 floors overhead, and Tiffany lamps dotted the lower level, which centered on an enormous field stone fireplace. I barely noticed any of it, though. I was already thinking about Inspector Hughes up in room 456. Amazing. I was on vacation. Chapter 8. Jamila greeted me at the door, lips first. A delicious kiss that warmed me from head to toe. I didn't get to see much of her wrap-around baby blue blouse and black pencil skirt until we pulled apart. Black sling-back heels put her at just about the right height for me. She sure didn't look like a homicide cop today.
I just got in, she said.
Just in time, I murmured, reaching for her again. Jamila's kisses were always like coming home. I started to wonder where all this was going, but then I stopped myself.
Just let it be, Alex. Thanks for the flowers, she whispered against my ear. All of the flowers. They're absolutely beautiful. I know. Not as beautiful as me.
I laughed out loud. That's true. I could see over her shoulder that the hotel's concierge, Harold Larson, had done a good job for me. Rose petals were scattered in a swath of red, peach, and white. I knew there were a dozen long stems on the bedside table, a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc in the mini-fridge, and a couple of carefully chosen CDs in the stereo. Best of Al Green, Luther Ingram, Tuck and Patty's Tears of Joy, some early Alberta Hunter.
I guess you really did miss me, Jamila said.
Suddenly, the two of us were like one body,
my mouth exploring hers, my hands holding her up from the rear. She already had my shirt half unbuttoned, and then I was reaching down her side for the zipper on her skirt. We kissed again, and her mouth was so fresh and sweet, like it always was. I danced her backward toward the bedroom. "How do you do this in heels?" I asked along the way. "You're right," she said, and kicked off her shoes even as her skirt slid to the floor. "We should light these candles," I said. "You want me to light them?"
"Shh, Alex. It's already warm enough in here."
"Yeah, it is." There wasn't a whole lot of talking for a while after that. Jamila and I always seemed to know what the other was thinking anyway. No conversation required at certain times. And I had missed her, even more than I thought I would. We pressed hard against each other, chest to chest, breathing in a nice rhythm. I rose and hardened against her leg, and I could feel moistness on my thigh. Then I reached up and held Jam's lovely face in both of my hands. I felt as though she could hear my thoughts. She smiled, drinking in what I hadn't even said.
"Is that so?"
she finally whispered, then winked. We had shared the mind-reading joke before. We kissed some more, and Jamila breathed deeply as I slowly worked my lips over her neck, her breasts, and her stomach. Everywhere I stopped, I wanted to stay, but just as badly, I couldn't wait to move on. She wrapped her arms around my back and rolled us both over on the bed. "How can you be so hard and so soft?" I asked.
"It's a woman thing. Just enjoy it.
But I could say the same about you. Hard and soft." A moment later, I was inside Jamila. She sat bolt upright, her head thrown back, her lower lip clenched tightly between her teeth. Sunlight reached through the bedroom window and slowly crossed her face. Absolutely gorgeous. All of it. We climaxed together. One of those ideals that everyone says is just an ideal, but it's not. Not always, anyway. She lay lightly down on top of me, the air slowly escaping from her lungs, our bodies melding as they always did.
"You're gonna be too tired for the rides tomorrow,"
she finally said and smiled. "Speaking of rides," I said. She started to laugh.
"Promises, promises.
But I always keep mine," I said. Chapter 9. I don't remember when Jamila and I eventually drifted off to sleep that afternoon, but I was woken up by my pager. My brand new pager. The one I got especially for this trip so only a few people would have the number. John Sampson, Director Burns' assistant, Tony Woods. That's about it. Two people too many? So what now? I groaned. Sorry, Jam. I didn't expect this. I don't have to answer it. The last part I said half-heartedly. We both knew better. Jamila shook her head.
I'll tell you a little secret. I've got mine here in the nightstand. Go ahead, Alex. Answer the call.
Yeah. Answer the call. Sure enough, it was the director's office reaching out from D.C. I picked up the bedside phone and dialed the number while lying there flat on my back. I finally looked at my watch. 4 p.m. The day had flown, which was a good thing. Sort of. Until now, anyway.
Ron Burns, I mouthed to Jamila while I was on hold. This can't be good. This has to be bad.
She nodded. A call from the top of the pyramid had to mean some kind of serious business that couldn't wait. Whatever it was, I didn't want to hear about it right now. Ron Burns himself came on the line. This was getting worse by the second.
Alex, is that you?
Yes, sir, I sighed. Just Jamila and me. And you.
I appreciate you taking this call. I'm sorry to be bothering you. I know it's been a while since your last real vacation. He didn't know the half of it, but I kept quiet and listened to what the director had to say. Alex, there's a kind of sticky case in L.A. I probably would have wanted to send you out on this one anyway. The fact that you're in California is a lucky coincidence. Lucky, of course, being a relative concept. I shook my head back and forth. This was sounding really bad. What's the case? This lucky coincidence that I'm out here? You ever heard of Antonia Shiffman? That got my attention a little. The actress? Sure. She was murdered this morning, along with her limo driver. It happened outside her home. Her family was inside sleeping. The rest of the family, they're okay? I asked. No one else was hurt, Alex. Just the actress and her driver. I was a little confused. Why's the Bureau on this? LAPD request a consult? Not exactly. Burns paused. If you wouldn't mind keeping this between the two of us, Antonia Shiffman was friends with the president and a close friend of his wife. The president has asked for our help on the murder investigation. Oh. I saw that Ron Burns wasn't quite as immune to Washington pressure as I had thought. Even so, he was the best thing that had happened to the FBI in a long time, and he'd already done me more than one favor in my short tenure. Of course, I had done him a few good turns, too. Alex, just do a quick in and out on this one. I'd really appreciate it. We'll have you back with your family for dinner. A late dinner, anyway. Just check out the murder scene for me. I want to hear your take on what happened. I took the liberty of... They're waiting for you to get there. I finished the call and cast a look at Jamila. Well, the good news is I don't have to fly anywhere. It's something in L.A. The actress Antonia Shiffman was murdered today. She pushed up next to me in bed. Oh, that's terrible, Alex. I liked her movies. She always seemed nice. That's really a shame. Well, at least I'll get to dish with Nana and the kids while you're out of earshot. I'll meet you all back here for dinner. Might be a little late. My flight's not until 11, Alex, but I have to be on the late flight out. I kissed her, just a little sheepishly, ashamed that I'd given in to Burns. But what choice did I have? Go make California safe. Safer, she said. I'll keep an eye on Mickey and Donald to make sure they don't go postal. What a thought.
Chapter 10. The storyteller drove right by the Shiffman murder scene. Right by the crime scene. He knew he shouldn't have come out here again, but he couldn't help himself. In a way, he thought this might even be a good idea. So he stopped his car and got out to look around. What an incredible rush it turned out to be. He knew the house, knew the ritzy neighborhood in Beverly Hills really well. Miller Place. Suddenly, he almost couldn't catch his breath, and he loved the feeling of danger, of anything can happen now. And it definitely could. He was the storyteller, after all. The press was everywhere, along with the LAPD, of course, and even some police brass. And he'd had to park about a quarter of a mile away. I was fine with him. Safer. Smarter. A minute or so later, he joined in with fans and other looky-loos, making the pilgrimage to the shrine where poor Antonia had checked out of the rat race this morning.
I can't believe she's dead,
a young couple was saying as they walked arm in arm, heads bowed as if they'd lost a real loved one. What was with some people? Could anybody be this nuts? I can believe she's dead, he wanted to tell them. First, I put one in her head. Then I hacked her face until her own mother wouldn't recognize her. Believe it or not, there's even a method to my madness. There is a grand plan, and it's a beauty. But he didn't speak to the creepy bereaved.
just made his way to the pearly gates of the Schiffman house. He stood there respectfully with the others, probably a couple of hundred mourners. The Beverly Hills sideshow was just getting started, just getting warmed up. Man, this was some huge story. And guess what? Not one of these reporters had the real story. Not about Antonia, and not about her murder. Only he did. He was the only person in L.A. who knew what had happened, where it was going, and it felt pretty good to be in the know. "Hey, how you doing?" he heard. The storyteller froze, then turned slowly to see who was talking to him. He recognized the guy's face, but not exactly who the hell it was. Where do I know this jerk from? "Geez, it was just passing by. Heard what happened on the radio, so I stopped to pay my respects, or whatever this is. What a shame. Some tragedy, huh? This crazy world out here. You just never know," said the storyteller, realizing he was babbling a little bit. The other guy said, "No, you never do. Who the hell would want to kill Antonia Schiffman? What kind of maniac? What kind of complete lunatic?" "Out here in L.A., said the storyteller, "it could be anybody, right?"
Chapter 11. 15 minutes after the call from D.C., a black Grand Marquis was waiting for me outside the Disneyland Hotel. I shook my head in disappointment, but also in anger. This sucked in a way that broke new territory. The FBI agent standing next to the car wore a pair of neatly pressed khakis and a pale blue polo shirt. He looked ready for a round of golf at the Los Angeles Country Club. His handshake was vigorous and a little too eager. "Special Agent Carl Page, I'm really glad to meet you, Dr. Cross. I've read your book," he said, "a couple of times." He couldn't have been long out of the academy at Quantico from the look of him. The California tan and nearly white blonde flat top suggested that he was a local boy, probably in his mid-20s. An eager beaver, for sure. "Thank you," I said. "Exactly where are we headed, Agent Page?" Page shut his mouth abruptly and nodded his head. Maybe he was embarrassed that he hadn't thought to answer my question before I asked it. Then he started up again. "Yes, of course. We're headed to Beverly Hills, Dr. Cross. The scene of the homicide, where the victim lived." "Antonia Schiffman," I said, with a sigh of regret. "That's right. Have you already been briefed?" "Actually, no. Not very well, anyway. How about you tell me what you know on the way over to the house? I want to hear everything." He turned toward the car as if to open the door for me, thought better of it, and got in on the driver's side. I climbed in the back, and once we were on our way, Page loosened up a little as he told me about the case. "They're coding this one Mary Smith. That's because there was an email from a so-called Mary Smith sent to an entertainment editor at the L.A. Times last week, taking responsibility for the first homicide." I think my eyes might have crossed. "Wait. This case has been coded already?" "Yes, sir." "So this isn't an isolated incident?" I could hear the tension in my own voice. Had Burns withheld that information from me? Or hadn't he known himself? "No. This is at least the second murder, Dr. Cross. Too early to classify it as anything, but there's an indication of solo activity, an organized approach, possibly psychosis, and maybe some level of ritual by the same person at each of the two murder sites. We also believe the killer is a woman, which makes this very unusual." So Page did know a thing or two. Meanwhile, I couldn't help feeling duped by Burns. Why couldn't he have just told me the truth? We were scarcely off of the Disneyland property, and already this murder case was a whole lot more complicated than he'd made it seem. "Son of a bitch," I said between gritted teeth. I was getting tired of being played, and maybe tired of the Bureau, too. But maybe I was just in a bad mood because I'd been pulled away from my vacation. Page stiffened. "Is there a problem?"
It would have been easy to blow off a little steam with him, but I wasn't ready to start bonding with Agent Page yet. The whole idea was to float through this case as unattached as possible. No big problem. Nothing to do with you, anyway. Let's get over to the murder scene. I'm only supposed to take a quick look.
Yes, sir.
I caught Page's blue eyes in the rearview mirror. You don't have to call me sir. I'm not your dad, I said. Then I grinned, just in case he couldn't tell it was a joke.
Chapter 12. Here we go again.
The president has asked for our help. I want to hear your take on what happened.
My take? That was a laugh. My take was that I was being used, and I didn't like it. Also, I hated it when I whined like this. We took the Santa Ana Freeway into downtown Los Angeles, and then the Hollywood Freeway back out again. Agent Page drove with a kind of automatic aggressiveness, passing cars closely and frequently. One cell phone using businessman took his other hand off the wheel long enough to give us the finger. Page seemed oblivious to all of this as he sped northward and told me what else he knew about the grisly double murder. Both Antonia Schiffman and her driver, Bruno Capoletti, had been shot somewhere between 4 and 5:30 in the morning. A gardener had discovered the bodies around 7:15. Schiffman's beautiful face had also been slashed with a sharp blade of some kind. Apparently, no money or other valuables had been taken. Bruno Capoletti was found with almost $200 in his pocket, and Schiffman's handbag was still in the limo next to her body. It held credit cards, diamond earrings, and more cash. "Any prior connection between the two of them?" I asked. "Schiffman and the limo driver? What do we know about the two of them?" The only other movie of hers Capoletti worked on was Banner Season, but he drove for Jeff Bridges on that one. We're still checking the driver out, though. You ever see Banner Season?
No, I didn't.
How hot is the crime scene? Our people, LAPD, the media? Anything else I should know before we arrive?
I haven't actually been there yet, Page admitted. But it's probably going to be off the charts. I mean, it's Antonia Schiffman, you know. She was a really good actress. Supposed to be a nice lady.
Yes, she was. It's a shame. She had kids, too. 4 little girls, Andy, Elizabeth, Tia, and Petra, said Page, who clearly liked to show off. Minutes later, we were off the highway and driving west on Sunset. I watched as the cityscape changed from the cliché-defying urban grittiness of downtown Hollywood to the lush green and cliché residential avenues of Beverly Hills. Rows of palm trees looked at us from above as if down their noses. We turned off Sunset and drove up Miller Place, a winding canyon drive with stunning views of the city behind us. Finally, Page parked on a side street. Television and radio vans were everywhere. Their satellite towers extended into the air like huge sculptures. As we got closer, I spotted CNN, KTLA, KYSR, Star 98.7, Entertainment Tonight. Some of the reporters stood facing cameras with their backs to the estate, presumably reporting live on the LA and network shows. What a circus. So why do I have to be here too? I'm supposed to be at Disneyland, a kinder, gentler circus. None of the media people recognized me. A refreshing change from D.C. Agent Page and I politely made our way through the crowd to where 2 uniformed police officers stood guard. They looked carefully at our creds.
"This is Dr. Alex Cross," said Page.
"So?" said the uniform. I didn't say a word. "So?" seemed like an appropriate response to me. The uniform finally let us pass, but not before I noticed something that made me a little sick to my stomach. James Truscott, with his cascading red hair, was standing there in the crowd of reporters. So was his camera person, the same woman, dressed all in black. Truscott saw me too,
and nodded my way. A smile may have even crossed his lips. He was taking notes. She was taking photographs. Of me. Chapter 13. I was cursing softly as Paige and I followed a long, circular, white-pebbled driveway up to the main house. Mansion was definitely a better word for this place. A two-story Spanish-style construction. Dense foliage on all sides blocked my view past the facade, but the main house had to be at least 20,000 square feet, probably even more. Who needed this much space to live? Our house in D.C. was under 3,000, and that was plenty of room for us. A series of balconies rimmed the second floor. Some of them looked down onto the driveway, where a black limo was cordoned off with yellow crime scene tape. This was where Antonia Schiffman and Bruno Capoletti had died. The area around the limo was blocked off in a wide circle with only one way in and out. Two more LAPD officers took names as people came and went. Tex in white bunny suits were going over the car with a handheld USB microscope and evidence vacuums. A few others were snapping Polaroids as well as regular photographs. Another whole squad was already fanned out, taking exemplars from the surrounding area. It was all fairly impressive, as well as depressing. The best forensic police department in the world is supposed to be Tokyo's. Domestically, though, Los Angeles and New York were the only departments that could rival the FBI's resources. "We're in luck, I guess," Paige said. "Looks like the ME's just finishing up." He pointed toward the medical examiner, a heavy-set, gray-haired woman standing next to the limo and speaking into a handheld recorder. That meant the bodies hadn't been removed. I was surprised, but it was good news for me. The less disturbed the crime scene, the more information I could get for Burns, and the president, and his wife. I supposed that was why the bodies hadn't been moved. The dead were waiting on me. I turned back to Paige. "Tell whoever's in charge from the LAPD not to move anything yet. I want to get a clean look. And try to clear some of these people out of here. Necessary personnel only. Fibers, printing, but that's it. Everyone else is on break." For the first time that morning, Paige paused before he responded. This was an all-business side of me he hadn't seen. Not that I'm big on throwing my weight around, but right now I had to use it. There was no way I could do a proper job in the middle of all this chaos and confusion. "Oh, and one other thing you should tell whoever's in charge," I said. Paige turned back. "Yeah? Tell them as long as I'm here, I'm in charge." Chapter 14. I could still hear Director Burns' voice in my head. "I want to hear your take on what happened. We'll have you back with your family for dinner. But would I want to eat after this?" With two dead bodies still inside, the limousine was absolutely fetid. One of the best tricks I'd learned was to gut it out for about 3 minutes until the olfactory nerves were numb. Then I'd be fine. I just had to get through those 3 minutes that told me I was back in the homicide business. I focused and took in the grisly details one by one. First came a shocker that I wasn't ready for, even though I partly knew it was coming. Antonia Schiffman's face was almost completely unrecognizable. A portion of the left side was gone altogether where she had been shot, probably at close range. What flesh remained, mostly the right eye, cheek, and her mouth, had been slashed several times. The killer, Mary Smith, had been in a frenzy, but only against Antonia Schiffman, not the driver, or so it seemed. The actress's clothing appeared to be intact. No indication of any kind of sexual assault, and no sign of blood froth from the nostrils or mouth, which meant she died and stopped breathing almost immediately. Who would make this kind of violent attack? Why Antonia Schiffman? She'd seemed like a nice person, got good press,
and everybody liked her, according to, well, everybody. So what could explain this massacre, this desecration at her home? Agent Page appeared and leaned in over my shoulder. What do you think the cutting is about? Some kind of reference to plastic surgery, maybe? The young agent had shaken off every subtle and not-so-subtle clue I had dropped that I needed to be alone right now. But I didn't have the heart to dress him down. I don't think so, I said. But I don't want to speculate yet. We'll know more once she's checked in and cleaned up. Now please let me work, Paige, I thought. A dull brown wash of dried blood covered the actress's ruined face. What a terrible waste. And what exactly was I supposed to relay to the president about what I'd seen here? About what had happened to his friend? The driver, Bruno Capoletti, was still propped up at the steering wheel. A single bullet had entered his left temple before it destroyed most of his head. The blood on the empty seat next to him was smeared, possibly by his own body, but more likely by the killer, who had apparently shot Antonia Schiffman from the front seat. A small amount of cocaine had been found in the driver's jacket pocket. Did it mean anything? Probably not, but I couldn't rule out anything yet. I finally stepped out and away from the limousine and took a breath of fresh air. There's a strange disconnect going on here, I said, more to myself than to anyone else. Neat and sloppy? Paige asked. Controlled, yet out of control. I looked at him and my mouth twisted into something resembling a smile. The insight surprised me a little. Yes. Exactly. The bodies had been arranged just so inside the car. But the shooting, and in particular the cuts on Schiffman's face, had an angry, haphazard quality to them. There was a calling card, too. A row of children's stickers was affixed to the car door. Glittery, bright-colored pictures of unicorns and rainbows. The same kind had apparently been left at the scene of the previous week's murder. Each of the stickers was marked with a capital letter, two with an A, one with a B. What was that all about? Paige had already briefed me on the companion case to this one. Another woman in the movie business, Patsy Bennett, a successful production head, had been shot dead in a movie theater in Westwood 6 days prior. There were no witnesses. Bennett was the only victim that day, and there had been no knife work. But the stickers at that